Masuda Sultan lost 19 members of her family in the U.S. attack on Afghanistan in October 2001, the attack the United States called Operation Enduring Freedom. Those 19 people were among the estimated 3,000 Afghan civilians who died in the U.S. bombing up until March of the following year, bombing that was inflicted by B-52 and B-2 stealth bombers and cruise missiles fired from subs in the Arabian Sea. 3 years later, in October of last year, George W. Bush publicly claimed that Afghanistan was on the road to freedom and to democracy, as seen in the elections held over the course of that month. Predictably, the U.S.-backed candidate, Hamid Karzai, won handily. Joining us now is Masuda Sultan to talk about those elections, what they meant and what they didn't mean. Welcome to CKLN.
Thank you for having me on.
So as I told you, as we were lining up this talk this evening, all this week we're looking at the upcoming elections in Iraq, scheduled for Sunday, when the Coalition Provisional Authority is hoping to hold elections for the 270 or so members of the Transitional National Assembly. And now a lot of people are going to be boycotting the election there, and there's a lot of uncertainty whether people feel at all invested in this political process, or even if they're safe enough to leave their homes to vote. And I want to ask you first, how does that experience compare to the Afghan experience last fall? Like, how did people in Afghanistan themselves approach the election?
Well, Afghanistan is slightly different scenario. I think a lot of Afghan people were looking forward to voting, were hoping that this would open a new chapter in that country's history, but at the same time were very skeptical about the process, because as I visited Kabul and Kandahar, learned that many of them were skeptical about the registration process, which in many cases didn't involve enough female registration workers. As you fast forward through to election day on October 9th, 2004, there were a lot of allegations of irregularities and fraud, dealing with everything from ink that was supposed to be indelible that actually washed off so that people could vote multiple times. And there was an actual boycott of the election on election day by 15 members of the opposition who were running for president against President Karzai. So I think that going into the elections, the Afghans were perhaps not as skeptical as the Iraqis, and there weren't any sort of mass boycotts of the elections. However, as the registration process wore on, and particularly on election day, there was a lot of noise about fraud, which eventually a UN independent council was formed, a commission of three people, who, not surprisingly, found that none of the irregularities significantly affected the outcome.
Let's go over these areas one at a time. I can remember the U.S. sort of crowing that 40% of those registered were women, and remarking on that as a sign of remarkable progress or something. But when you actually look at it, it's not even a really great statistic, given that women make up 60% of the population in Afghanistan. So what barriers to women's participation were there and are there still?
Well, what most people don't realize about that 41% figure, as you mentioned, the population of women is over 60%, but that in many provinces, actually in 13 of the 34 provinces, there was over-registration by more than 140%. And in provinces in the south, only 10% of registrants were women. For example, in Zabul province, only 9% of voters in Uruzgan province were women, and 16% in Helmand province. So you sort of had over-registration in some areas and under-registration, particularly by women, in areas in the south, so that 41% figure is actually misleading. Speaking to women in Kandahar prior to the election, I actually have a very good friend of mine who's Afghan-American working in Kandahar, and right before election was speaking with her, and she was not planning on voting. And I was shocked, because she sort of serves as a role model for local Afghan women there, and she said that she had promised her parents that she would not go out and vote because it was too dangerous. And this is someone who takes pride in the reconstruction of her country. Many of the Afghan women there had told her, despite registering and saying that they would vote, that actually on election day their families felt that it was too dangerous, and they themselves felt the same way. And in fact, a lot of the women, female workers, ended up pulling out on election day, and that was a problem later on that they cited for not being able to run the polls properly.
Were there candidates that were more sympathetic to women's issues and demands that you know, ended up losing support because of this, or how did, what kind of effect do you think that would have on the overall election?
Well, one of the candidates for president who was a more of a women's rights activist probably than any other candidate, including the sole female candidate, one of the candidates was essentially written off by the mullahs, the warlords, and a majority of the population because he questioned whether Afghan women have the right to divorce. He wanted to start a dialogue on that subject, and he received numerous death threats and was essentially, his candidacy was undermined. The sole female presidential candidate, Masuda Jalal, it was stated that she didn't comment on the issue, and understandably so, because she herself has received death threats and fears for her life. Now, I met with her few months prior to the elections. She was campaigning with absolutely no campaign staff, no campaign funding, and no campaign office. In fact, she had to quit her UN job because of the rules of running for office as a UN staff person, and did not even have an email address to which we could access her. So she pointed out how difficult it was as a woman running, in sole female candidate running in the election. She pointed out that a lot of the other candidates had funding from a variety of foreign sources, and without naming President Karzai, essentially said that, of course, he's going to win. He's the front runner. He's the foreign favorite, and he's the one that's getting all the funding.
Now, I want to ask you about the sort of security issues. I suppose I understand that there's a kind of a general security problem where people are afraid to, it's not safe necessarily for women to be in the public sphere or participating in political processes like an election. But then there's also the more specific issue of, like, in certain regions where the warlords of the Northern Alliance and other factions control the public space, and it's dangerous for people to take a position against them. Can you say more about that, or correct me if I'm mischaracterizing the situation?
Or actually, over 60% of Afghans surveyed said that security was their number one concern, and over 65% of them said that it was directly as a result of warlords being in power and threatening their safety. And this is going to be a particular concern as the parliamentary elections come in April of this year. And I think that, you know, looking at the presidential elections, while there was some violence and these allegations of fraud and irregularities, overall it was not quite the level of violence that people expected. Again, this is not Iraq. What really concerns me is with parliamentary elections, it's a completely different game, in the sense that these local warlords, this is their opportunity to exert control, to exert influence, and gain power at the local level, to really legitimize the power that they hold over the Afghan people. With the presidential elections, Karzai was already the front runner. Everybody sort of knew that he would win. It was more of a formality to go out and vote. With the local elections, it's more serious business. Local elections for parliament will really determine if Afghanistan is prepared for democracy.
Mm-hmm. Now, I want to move and talk a little bit about the situation, rather than just focusing on the relationships within Afghanistan. I mean, obviously, everything is determined in large part by the presence of foreign troops and, you know, the outside powers, United States and NATO. And today the White House announced that it's going to be asking for yet another supplementary item to the annual budget, another $80 billion to help pay for the wars in Iraq and in Afghanistan. And Bush specifically mentioned, quote, the continued pursuit of Al-Qaeda and other terrorist elements in Afghanistan and elsewhere. And while he was also talking about Afghanistan's great progress, and I want to, can you give us a brief idea of what kind of military presence the U.S. is maintaining in Afghanistan right now? And I'm sorry, I don't really understand how that's related to the NATO-led International Security Assistance Force. If you could try and summarize that for us.
Okay. Well, the International Security Assistance Force is essentially, they're peacekeepers, and they're technically not going to intervene even if there is, for example, if there's military violence. They're more sort of for show. Afghans have been asking from the very beginning for ISAF, International Security Assistance Forces, to be stationed throughout the country, because Afghans feel that just merely with the presence of these ISAF forces, they feel safer. They feel like the power of the warlords is undermined by the presence of these foreigners. On the other hand, the American troops, which I don't know what the figures are most recently, but probably numbering over 10,000, are positioned there mostly to wage war against Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. And although there are reconstruction teams going out doing reconstruction in Afghanistan, it's primarily strategic. In other words, they're trying to befriend Afghans who can then provide information and resources to capturing and killing Al-Qaeda and Taliban members. So a force of over 10,000 American troops, I believe, haven't checked on that recently, and a force of about 8,000 NATO troops, ISAF troops, which are located in very strategic places in Afghanistan. For example, most of them are in Kabul, which is already particular, you know, one of the safest place really in Afghanistan. And unfortunately, they can't expand to a lot of the cities that need them because it's just not safe enough. And it's just so ironic that with Afghanistan, as I am noticing with Iraq, this issue of, you know, foreigners can't go in to some of the most desperate places in the country because it's not, just not safe enough. In Afghanistan, there were under 200 international monitors for the election, and the reason that there were so little is that it just wasn't safe for them. In Iraq, as I understand it, there are going to be no international monitors inside the country. They're going to be based in Jordan, precisely for the same reason of security. And it breaks my heart to know that, you know, if it's too dangerous to send in international elections monitors, then how can you expect average Iraqis with absolutely no defense, no ability to defend themselves, to go out and risk their lives?
I have a lot of other questions to ask you, but unfortunately we're going to have to wrap this up, and I think that's a good note to end on. So I really want to thank you for joining us this evening.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for remembering Afghanistan.